So Anthony and I are going to switch gears now. Of course, the other part of our news here nationally is the Republican National Convention, despite Isaac postponing it. We're not talking about the biblical Isaac. But
that's right. Tropical storm Isaac seems to have pushed at least a day and a half worth of activities back for the Republicans as they gather
at
in
least.
Tampa.
At so least. We'll be covering it on a lot of levels on today's show and in the coming days is what's going on there. You'll be hearing correspondence later in the week from our sister stations around the country who are covering it in Tampa. We'll be talking to people from Black Entertainment Television tomorrow who are covering it. We'll be looking at today we'll be talking about, as we often have, and again, issues of race and the Republican Party, which we're going to talk about with in some intensity here for the next 25 minutes or half an hour or so. We'll be talking later in the program to the Green Party vice presidential candidate, Sherry Honkala, who is there with Romneyville, poor people who have set up an encampment, and we'll talk to her about what that's about. And then we'll talk to the former Republican governor of Maryland, Bob Ehrlich, who is at the Republican National
Convention. And the chairman here in the state for the Romney campaign.
And the chairman of the Romney campaign in the state. But race is a huge issue when it comes to Republicans. And I think that, Anthony, before we introduce our guests, I'll let you jump in. Let me just throw this out and see what you think as well. You know, that you can't call all Republicans racist, nor can you say there are no racists inside the Democratic Party, for sure.
For sure.
Right? To be conservative is not to be racist, it's to have a political ideology. But there are arguments to be made that Republicans have in the past and do it now. Use campaign rhetoric and advertising that appeals to the racist undertones of America, from Willie Horton to Romney saying he just said it, didn't really mean by it, that no one asked me for my birth certificate, or the idea that black folks take government money, with Obama wants to change welfare back so even the majority of people who get welfare in America are white. That's not the image that America has of welfare, right?
And certainly Obama's not actually involved in welfare reform at that level. So there's a lot of rhetoric built around this.
And you have everything to look at this Republican convention, which may be the whitest convention in the Republican Party history, down from its high in 2000, I think, 2004. Mm-hmm. What is that link? And why do minorities are not part of the Republican Party? And why is it a bastion of white America, then let's introduce the guest, but go ahead.
Yeah, and I think, Mark, it's very important what you said about a political ideology, because both of us know that both of us have involved in our life friendships with African-American conservatives, Latino conservatives, and it's an ideology. It is a political thought and a way of thinking. But it is clear that the Republican Party does not enjoy a productive relationship, and they've been trying with outreach. They had an African-American chairman who made it one of his priorities that minorities be more engaged in the party. And I would say the argument is they failed miserably, because I was amazed at even the early coverage of the convention. The folks who are involved in the faith-based institution and activism for the party spoke yesterday. And I watched speaker after speaker after speaker go and assail the importance of faith activism. And Mark, one was African American out of about 20 speakers that I saw. The party has a problem, and it's not a problem as we see it. It is a problem for them, because they do seek, and I believe with good conscience, they seek to represent everyone in this country. But there is it appears to be a real disconnect with a large segment of our population.
So we are joined right now by Sally Kahn, who is a political commentator. She's on Fox News and other places, community organizer, founder of the Movement Vision Lab, a grassroots think tank, Dr. Gerald Alexander, associate professor of politics at the University of Virginia. And I think he's not here yet, but soon to be here is Earl O'Fari Hutchinson, political analyst and author of 10 books, including The Latino Challenge to Black America. Number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Jump on to our Facebook page, and we'll read your comments there as well. And Sally and Gerard, welcome. Good to have you both with us.
Good to be here.
Great to be with you.
And so, Sally, let me just start with you. I mean, you had a kind of burning critique that was in Color Lines. Talk about your perception of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, I agree. But sort of what you were touching on before, that sort of saying racism, racist, these are powerful and loaded words that you want to reserve for the most overt cases. And I think you overuse them and they tend to lose their power. But I think it's entirely appropriate in the context of this political campaign, the Republican campaign and Romney's campaign, to suggest that they are very deliberately mobilizing racial resentment and trying to trigger and stir a racialized distaste with President Obama. And so it's not just when Mitt Romney calls the president, accuses the president of an assault on American values or of changing the fabric of our land. That's part of it. And then it's sort of that's playing into, as you suggested, this is a comment about the birth certificate. Is it a joke? Is it not a joke? It's playing into things that others in the party and Romney's surrogates are saying as well. Notably when John Sununu says that President Obama needs to learn how to be an American. When Romney fundraiser Donald Trump questions Obama's Americanness, et cetera. When Gingrich calls him the food stamp president and then the Romney campaign comes out and attacks him on welfare. This all builds on a larger narrative to say, he's not American, he's not like you, he's black, he's different, he's scary, and that's what they're trying to do instead of going after him on issues.
And Gerard Alexander, I'd like to hear your response to that. I know that you have a very different take.
I guess I do have a different take. Everything that was just said that's been gone over the last few minutes on the show, including the last moment, all sounds very plausible to me. The problem is I'm always unsure what to do when the shoe is on the other foot. So, for example, some years ago, the Weekly Standard magazine, the conservative magazine, finally got struck by how often they were hearing that conservatives accused liberals of being un-American or unpatriotic during, let's say, the debate over the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
And so they finally did these big searches of the White House database to see whether Bush or Cheney had ever used those words, and then LexisNexis searches of newspapers and statements on television shows. And they found this whole series of occasions on which, let's say, Democratic senators or members of Congress, members of the House, had felt very comfortable saying of certain Republican proposals that they were un-American because they were anti-poor, they were, not inclusive enough, they didn't protect the social safety net, whatever the values they may have been violating, they were un-American. And that I think it was, if memory serves, even House Speaker Pelosi had used that language about, I think it was an attorney general, but please don't quote me on that, but just that generally that language was out there. Or I also remember that when the language was used that Republicans, among Republicans, that they wanted to take back America, that was seen as also a very suspicious kind of language because it implied that America was in alien hands and that they needed to be taken back from them, until it turned out that, Howard Dean's organization had been called something like Taking Back America, and that he'd spoken at a big convention called Taking Back America, meaning taking it back from conservatives. And I guess what I'm left always confused by is it sounds very plausible to me that when there's this otherizing of liberals by conservatives, that's taken as possibly about race. But when liberals use the exact same language or the exact same imagery, that's not at all about something as suspicious or disturbing or unsettling as that. And I'm left a little confused that it sounds right, except that it's all in the ear of the beholder, and that when liberals use the exact same formulations and frames, for some reason that's okay. For them to be talked about as assaulting America or assaulting its best values, that's all right. That's just issues. But when conservatives accuse liberals of that, something is wrong with that. Something is suspicious about that. And I just am left unsure. How do we know that this isn't just ideological? How do we know that this isn't just partisan? How do we know that this is really rigorous analysis of what's really going on?
So before we come back to Sally, I think we've also just been joined by Earl O'Farrell Hutchinson, political analyst and author of 10 books, a prolific writer. Earl, welcome. Good to have you back with us. It's been a while.
It's been a while. Good to be back.
Good to have you back. So your thoughts on this conversation, you heard Gerard Alexander. I don't know if you heard what Sally Kahn said earlier, but just the whole idea of this complexity of the juncture of race in the Republican Party, and respond to what Gerard was saying.
Well, I think there is a way, and there is a litmus test to tell whether it's just strictly partisan or ideological. I think it's both. When liberals and conservatives go after each other and use cold words, cold language, and cold terms. But I think we do have a test, and the test is history. If we go back in time, we know, going back to Richard Nixon, 1968, law and order, crime in the streets, welfare cheats, all the kinds of terms that were used then essentially to rev up a white Southern base. Because remember, there was a term called the Southern Strategy, and we're hearing a lot of that again today, where essentially the Southern Strategy was that the GOP would use code words, code language, code terminology. You never could use crude race, because remember, that was outdated. You couldn't go back in time and do that. So you substituted the code language, always with a wink and a nod, that essentially it was understood in the white South, where the GOP was trying to build a powerful base and did a pretty good job, that essentially we're talking about poor African Americans. That was understood without even saying that. So when we fast forward 40-plus years, we're still hearing a lot of the same kinds of language, terms, and phraseology. But what has not changed is essentially it's still appealing, even pandering to, a very conservative, ultra-conservative base in the South and the heartland. That is the GOP's bread and butter, and that hasn't changed. So that's not just liberal and conservative playing around with terms. That is a fact of life, political life, when it comes to the GOP. That's their base. That's their strength. They have to play to it.
Mm-hmm. Mark, can I jump in for one quick second?
Go ahead, Gerard. Then we'll take a break and come right back to all three of you.
Again, I'm not suggesting that these charges aren't plausible. Of course they are, given that history, that very real and painful history. The problem is there's got to be something wrong with what you just said. It has got to be possible to talk about crime as a problem and what to do about it, including punishments and not just underlying social root causes, without being racial about it. It's got to be possible to talk about welfare without being racial about it. And one of the funny things that's happened as a result of this concern, that just to talk about those things, just to bring them up in any kind of way to mobilize votes, that must be inherently racial and therefore very disturbing, very unsettling, is that it made Democrats, many liberals, terrified to talk about those things. And who did that hurt over the last 25, 30 years? It hurt liberals most of all, because they were so afraid to talk about crime that they let Republicans get that issue. They were so afraid to talk about welfare and welfare reform that until Bill Clinton and others felt that their backs were to the wall on it electorally, they didn't want to talk about it because they didn't want to be accused of racism. So it seems to me very ironic that this very legitimate concern that those things can be about race was turned into them almost by definition as being about race. Very rare is the case where a politician can say we've got to do something about crime, and someone somewhere won't accuse them of being racial.
Right. So Sally, we have to take an ID break, and we're going to come back in literally like 90 seconds or less. And when we do, Sally Khan, please jump right back in, and Earl, and we'll go to our listeners as well.
And I'll promise to shut up.
No.
We don't want you to shut up.
Not at all.
You're here to speak.
There's an easy answer.
We're discussing radio rather than talk radio. So we'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy.
Our guest this hour, at least part of our hour anyway, Sally Khan, who is a political commentator. You see her on Fox, many other places. Community organizer, founder of the movement Vision Lab, a grassroots think tank. Has been on the show in a while. She's back again. It's been a long while. Gerard Alexander is an associate professor of politics at the University of Virginia. Earl Ofari Hutchinson, political analyst, author of 10 books, and one of our leading political commentators. 410-319-8888. Lamar, we're going to come to your call, but I want to let Sally and Earl come back in with their thoughts. Sally, you've been dying to jump through the phone microphone. So leap, Ms. Khan, leap.
Well, look, I sort of think that this kind of general tone of kind of false moral equivalence where, and I'm not accusing Gerard of saying this, but I want to sort of nip this in the bud, this sort of general idea of, oh, the Democrats are the ones in, you know, doing the nasty tone thing in this election and the Republicans' hands are clean. I mean, I will agree with you that everybody's hands get, you know, sort of muddied up in elections on both sides. You know, it strikes me, Gerard, a couple of things. Number one, context does matter. This is my point in the piece in Color Lines. People can find it at Sally Khan, KOHN.com. This is my point there. It's not just one isolated remark, two isolated remarks. This is a pattern of remarks. And again, there's a difference to me in saying, I think that leadership is un-American, I think that direction is un-American, and questioning the president's American-ness. And I don't think it's actually even a subtle difference, frankly. It also strikes me, to sort of go back at what you're saying, that, you know, once upon a time, in fact, even in this election cycle, Republicans have touted, in past election cycles, have touted some of the very same things that President Obama has done, have said that, you know, there's a role for government in creating business, have advanced the individual mandate in health care reform, have proposed cap and trade in the first place, and yet accuse the president, anytime he mentions any of these things, let alone tries to do them, of socialism. So, you know, again, to me, that's an example of hyperbole that is completely unfounded if you actually look at the objective facts of the situation. And in this case, I think, while you may be right, there may be some cases where it's, you know, uncalled for. If you look at the general trend of trying to present the president as this foreign, less than American, less than the rest of us, sort of other, I think it's overwhelmingly clear, and it's irresponsible of us not to point it out.
Now, Earl, and then we'll Earl of Harry Hutchinson, please.
Yeah, well, you know, let me deal frontally with what Mark said. He mentioned two things. He mentioned crime and welfare. Here's what Mark said. Mark said it should be a way to talk about crime and or welfare without bringing race into it. I mean, after all, these are legitimate public policies.
Oh, you mean Gerard said that?
Yeah.
I didn't say that.
Here's the problem with that. They are, but race is brought into by the GOP. Let me give you three examples, and I'll throw in another one. Food stamps, crime in the streets. Theoretically, in a perfect world, you could say, yes, crime victimizes everybody. We can talk about it. It's legitimate public, a policy issue. We have to get a handle on it, period, without any color reference whatsoever. Let me give you an example. When we talk about welfare, Ronald Reagan, over and over again, Ronald Reagan, when he was running the first time, he didn't just, when he, in his political advertising and all of his campaign literature and his speeches, when he kept talking about the welfare mother, the welfare cheat, he went to Chicago. He had black women, always black, 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 black. Now, here's where he could have had, and the GOP could have had an opportunity not to bring race into it. Why don't you have some white welfare mothers? Why don't you have some Asian welfare mothers? Why don't you have some woman on the moon welfare mothers? Why was it just black? And I'll tell you, and every statistic, every survey has shown that they have more whites on welfare than blacks. Let's talk about crime. Willie Horton, do you remember that? George H. Bush Sr. If you just wanted to make crime a public policy issue, sans race, why didn't you have a white criminal? I think there are a few of them around. Why did you have a black convict? Why did you focus on that? You talk about food stamps. By every statistic I have seen, George Bush, W. Bush, we're talking about Junior in this case, during his administration, actually both administrations, actually the amount spent on food stamps, the number of food stamp recipients were actually higher than those during the Obama administration, but yet and still, I don't hear anybody calling George Bush the food stamp president, but I sure hear a lot from the GOP, Barack Obama as the food stamp president. So, Mark, the problem with that is these are legitimate public policy issues. Where it falls apart, and your argument falls apart, is the history has condemned the GOP. They have brought race into it. They have rammed race into it, and they have made it a racial issue when it shouldn't have to be, and actually isn't.
So, Gerard, I look at it, Anthony, you have lots to say about this as well. So.
I do. I'm very curious when we know that we have become a very polarized nation around politics. But I'm very curious to get Sally and Gerard and Earl's thoughts on when we talk about polarization and we talk about the politics of 2012, is it a fair assessment? When I have moderated conversations, I know when Mark has been out in the community, people will stand in the audience and say Barack Obama is the most polarizing president. And they say that in the context of it being a very bad thing, not citing any policy, not citing any politics. They say that the man, the president, has polarized our nation and therefore it's not good for our nation. What do you all think about that when we talk about the political personality of the president?
You want to let Gerard have a jump in here real fast. Go ahead.
I do worry about that. And I'm old enough to remember, and I'm some kind of Republican. I'm old enough to remember Republicans around me, friends of mine, who I think under Clinton developed a somewhat irrational hatred of the man. And there was the phrase Clinton hating or Clinton hatred.
Mm-hmm.
God knows there was a lot of that under George W. I mean, a lot of liberals and progressives loathed that man, hated that man.
accused him of being a Nazi, accused him of being a fascist, just at least as often, I think, as people have accused Obama of being a socialist. And there's that kind of Obama hatred now and a certain paranoia. There was a paranoia of many progressives that Bush wanted to create a dictatorship. Mainstream journals like the Nation magazine ran stories about how this was a gathering dictatorship and comparing it to the creation of authoritarian rule in some countries like interwar Germany. And now there's that kind of, I think, to some extent, a paranoia around Obama, the way there was about Ruby Ridge and other such under Clinton. I just do fear that we're living in an age when, and the internet, I think, subsidizes this a little bit. It facilitates that there were people who were once upon a time would have been written off as cranks, instead are given megaphones, and whether it's through, you know, running for office, even though they may not get anywhere near the nomination, to some cable television theatrics or what, but there is a polarization that I think is certainly not the product of the Obama presidency. It's a victim of it, of an era in which we live, in which I'm afraid that a lot of people talk past each other instead of to each other.
Mm. Sally, bring you back in here, and I do want to get some calls before we have to go hit our next segment. But, you know, one of the things that and I think everything, Gerard, what you're saying is real, and everything, and we all have this reality, what we're saying. But the problem seems to me is that what gets played to, and how it's played. I mean, like the new Dinesh D'Souza movie coming out, and we hope to have him on the air to talk about this movie. But you know, again, the anti-colonialists. Obama's going to create an anti-colonialist regime in the next 4 years that was started off by Newt Gingrich. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, when you talk about anti-colonialists, what are you talking about? You're talking about black folks rebelling against European nations that own them. So what does that conjure up in your mind? I mean, that's the problem.
Yeah, I mean, I do think, again, this sort of false equivalence, and I don't disagree with this, with a lot of what Gerard just said, but I think this sort of false equivalence, going back to that question, and suggesting that, you know, Obama is somehow uniquely and egregiously to fault for things that, A, have been going on part of both parties for decades, if not centuries, B, for things that Republicans have explicitly done in the past, and then more to the present, C, you know, there's a word, somebody's got to help me figure out a word for this, there's this sort of deflectification, I don't know what the word is, but, you know, it's where, you know, Republicans are sort of behind the scenes, the ones lighting the fire, and then they're trying to sort of, you know, say it's all just smoke and mirrors and that the other side is doing it, right? I mean, they, in other words, I think, are trying to use accusations at the president around tone, around, you know, direction policies are heading, et cetera, to deflect from their own culpability, which is clear, frankly, both in terms of tone and in terms of politics and policy more generally. So there's this incredible disingenuousness in it, and I think it's no wonder then that not only are people becoming more partisan and entrenched, which, you know, I believe the polls, I also believe what I see in my daily life, I think that is true, but more worrisomely, I think, people are just becoming checked out. There's a larger group of people who just have no belief in the system.
Right.
And I am maybe guilty of looking at it through my own prism. I do believe President Obama did try, because of his personality and his predilections, try to change that, to be a force for change in that. And again, I think it was the Republicans who said day one, we're not going to support anything this guy wants, even conservative ideas, even tax cuts, nothing, zero, zip, zilch. And then now try to turn around and say he's the one guilty of the partisan tone in Washington. It seems a little absurd to me.
No, we do have to take a break here to go to our next segment. But before we do, I promise our callers, at least one of these callers in. Lamar, you're on the air.
Oh, okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for calling.
I'm going to be very brief.
Okay.
Just to piggyback on what the gentleman said with regards to Howard Dean's rhetoric as far as being divisive, well, Howard Dean didn't win with his rhetoric. He didn't win the nomination for the Democratic president. He just become president. Also, however, the rhetoric on the right, it always wins. You know, as far as talking about Obama with socialism, that the public option was a government takeover of health care, but yet Occupation Wall Street, their rhetoric didn't win. So I don't know how it is that liberals, if their rhetoric is divisive, it doesn't help any particular politicians win, but on the right, all of their rhetoric wins, and I think it's because they get the bigger megaphone and the bigger voice.
On that note, I think we have to maybe get some closing very quick thoughts from our guest, and we have to move on to our next subject because Shreya Hankala, who is our next guest, we want to get on the air with us. But Earl Afari Hutchinson, Gerard Alexander, Sally Khan, first of all, thank you all for being with us. But I'd like you all just take a quick 30 seconds to sum up your thoughts. Earl?
Okay. First of all, Mark, let me take just 2 seconds to apologize to you. I have a bad connection out here in L.A. on the cell. It was Gerard. I didn't mean to put words in your mouth before. I didn't hear
especially
myself.
My words.
quick comment on that about division. All my apologies to you. A quick thought about polarization. You know, Mitch McConnell, Senate Minority Leader, said one thing from day one when Barack Obama, literally the first month he took office, he said, we're going to make this man a one-term president. When he said that, that sent a signal to the nation, certainly the GOP and the nation, that essentially we're not going to do anything.
We lost him there.
Oh, man.
No.
We lost that cell phone connection. Gerard, I'm sorry, you're up.
Let me just come off of that. I mean, that politics is a slugfest. There's no doubt about it. Politics can get nasty and does, and at the presidential level, the stakes are very high for both teams. That politics is a sport for, you know, to get in the mud over. That's not the same thing as identifying that one side is playing to something as base as bigotry. And all I can tell you is that traveling around a lot in conservative and Republican circles, I often find that accusations of racial of mobilizing racial sentiments is often just mystifying to conservatives. So at the very least, people who want to make that charge need to explain it to conservatives better than they have. And to say it's just cynical that they know exactly what they're doing, all I can tell you is talking to a lot of policy intellectuals, a lot of writers, a lot of academics who might be conservative and who are interested in these policy areas, they are not doing it completely cynically. And they, if there is an education to take place, it has to take place more effectively than it has so far.
And go ahead, Sally.
Yeah. Pleasure to be on with you. Enjoyed the conversation immensely.
Me too.
You know, I first of all think that, you know, one way to become educated is to listen seriously to the accusations as opposed to just dismissing them on, you know, sort of tonal grounds or something, I think. And I mean this for the larger Republican Party. If you want to take it seriously, if you want to do something about it, if you not don't want to be playing to racial resentment and anxiety, then listen when people critique some of the rhetoric that's out there in the campaign. You know, and I think the larger issue, though, is, look, if this was a race instead with Hillary Clinton and you had a Republican Party that was in overt and then in subtle ways reinforcing comments about, you know, her gender, her ability to multitask, her skirts, her this, her that, there would be no question that that would be gendering the debate and trying to sort of make gender an issue on a very subtle level in the election. And this is America. This is what we've done for centuries. And consciously or unconsciously, it's what we're doing again.
I want to thank all three for joining Anthony and I here doing this part of our program, Sally Khan, Gerard Alexander, and Earl Afari Hutchinson. It's been a pleasure. Look forward to talking to you all
Wonderful.
Again soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.